Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
This is Kevin Angle. I'm senior counsel in Holland & Knight's data strategy, security, and privacy practice. Today, we have the opportunity to discuss privacy enforcement with Michelle Lucan and Nick Farnsworth. There are now, I think it's 16 comprehensive privacy laws that have been passed in various states, although that's increasing, and so the number is changing constantly. There are five comprehensive privacy laws currently in effect, and comprehensive privacy laws are going to go into effect in Oregon and Texas beginning on July 1st. So this panel today, we have the opportunity to talk about how are these laws being enforced? What are the trends we see? What do we expect going forward? And we have the distinct honor to be joined by Michelle Lucan, who is the Deputy Associate Attorney General and Chief of the Privacy and Data Security Section at the Connecticut Office of the Attorney General. She was kind enough to join us last year to discuss her law before it went into operation. And she's back for more to discuss what she's seeing in terms of enforcement trends. She first joined the Attorney General's office in 2008 and served in its Consumer Protection Division and has been a guru of privacy for quite some time now. So thank you, Michelle, for joining. We're also joined by Nick Farnsworth, who's a senior associate in ORIC's Cyber Privacy and Data Innovation Practice. Nick has been a colleague of mine in the past and is a real leader in this space. He counsels clients on U.S. and international privacy, security, and data enablement requirements and strategies. Nick, I know one of your focuses has been artificial intelligence recently, and you've certainly been doing a lot in this in the privacy compliance space. And as mentioned, I'm counsel in Holland & Knight's data strategy practice. As with Nick, I provide counsel on compliance regarding U.S. state and federal privacy laws, as well as international regimes like the GDPR. So just to kick this off, Michelle, we're going to turn to you in a second to talk about the comprehensive report your office put out that was very helpful. But Nick, before we get into that, can you give us an overview of what you're seeing in terms of current regulatory activity outside of Connecticut before we do a deep dive there?
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Kevin. Like Kevin said, we're rapidly adding new states with comprehensive state privacy laws. Dare say we may be up to 20 by the time, you know, the next couple of months bear out.
By the time this webinar is over.
Yes. So the specifics of these laws do vary, but they generally follow a common theme, and they're typically going to impose obligations on companies that meet certain quantitative and qualitative thresholds. And those obligations that they impose are typically to implement core privacy principles relating to transparency, accuracy, data minimization, purpose and storage limitation, security and accountability, with specific requirements around disclosing the company's privacy practices in a clear and comprehensive privacy notice, honoring consumer rights to know whether a company is processing personal data about a consumer, access, correct, and delete personal data a company maintains about a consumer, limit the processing of sensitive personal data, and opt out of certain activities relating to the sale of personal data, processing of personal data for targeted advertising, and certain automated decision-making processes. The vast majority of states today are currently in the process of preparing for their effective date. And like Kevin mentioned, there's a couple coming into effect in July, Oregon and Texas being the predominant ones to think of. Others, though, are in the earlier stages of enforcement and are really starting to do enforcement at large. Colorado, Utah, and Virginia, as well as Connecticut, have been in effect for a bit of time now and are starting to take steps towards active investigation and enforcement. In Colorado, for example, we've seen a lot of efforts and significant resources being put towards finalizing regulations for the Colorado Privacy Act over the last year or so. And also taking steps in that state as well to begin to enforce against those regulations. Many of the initial rounds of letters that we're seeing across the states that are in effect are really focused on educating companies of their legal obligations under the law and sort of the first take, and particularly focusing on compliance with the law's sensitive data requirements, opt-out rights, and privacy disclosure obligations when it comes to more fulsome investigations. Now, all of these states are currently active and there's a lot of activity going on, but California is sort of at the front of most people's minds because it's been in effect for the longest, and that's the California Consumer Privacy Act. That is also the state where we see the most in terms of activity around investigations and enforcement, particularly because there is a unique aspect of the law that created a brand new regulatory body for enforcing privacy violations called the California Privacy Protection Agency. We've also seen the first settlements in relation to comprehensive privacy law in the United States coming out of California. Sephora was the first, and that hit in August of 2022. And that was really focused on the California Attorney General alleging that by obtaining free or discounted analytics and advertising benefits that were ultimately facilitated by third-party website trackers, Sephora was selling the personal data of consumers without disclosing this fact or providing an easy-to-find "Do not sell my personal information" link. That matter was settled between the AG and Sephora for a fine of $1.2 million, but also for obligations to continue to comply with the law and an ongoing monitoring period for 2 years. And most recently, we saw our second enforcement action in California under in relation to DoorDash, where the California Attorney General alleged that DoorDash sold consumers' personal data without providing notice or an opportunity to opt out of the sale by engaging in marketing cooperatives where unrelated businesses contributed personal data of their customers for the purpose of advertising their own products to customers from other participating businesses. That settlement resulted in a fine of $375,000 and a very similar form of non-financial obligations to comply with certain of the requirements under the California Consumer Privacy Act and a 3-year monitoring period. So while we're seeing a lot of increased attention from regulators on enforcement sort of across the board, Connecticut was nice enough to provide us some really, I think, helpful and insightful details around their own enforcement activity that we often don't get to see unless you happen to be subject to an investigation yourself. So Michelle, I'd love to turn it over to you to give us a bit more information about the report that your office produced and really focused on maybe on the beginning, why you produced it, why it was published, and why you chose the final form that it was ultimately published
Yeah.
in.
And Nick, sorry, I just want to make two points about what you were just covering. In terms of DoorDash and Sephora, a $375,000 dollar settlement, doesn't seem maybe like the largest settlement in the world, but I wouldn't overlook the injunctive terms. We have seen in terms of privacy enforcement, in many cases, a company will receive an initial settlement, but then that leads to an oversight monitoring period, which can then lead to further enforcement going forward. So yeah, I wouldn't overlook that aspect of the settlements as well. But Michelle, turning to you then about the Connecticut report.
Yes, of course. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me again. I can't believe it has been a year since I spoke with you all last. And I'm just thinking back on that time. We were really, we had hit the ground running trying to get ready to enforce our privacy law. The CTDPA is what we call it, Connecticut's Data Privacy Act. When I was speaking to you all last, we were, we were hiring, we were issuing resources under the law. We put together our FAQ page. We were doing events like this, and it's crazy to me how much time has flown. But I do want to spend some time talking about Connecticut's enforcement report that we issued on February 1st, and to give a little more background there. So it was nice to talk about all of our efforts to prepare under the law. It was a lot of legwork for us. I think because we took all of those efforts, we were able to hit the ground running. And so we really wanted to make sure this report was as useful as possible to folks in the legal community and the business community and to consumers. So yes, we issued this report on February 1st. And it covered the first 6 months of enforcement. So our law took effect in July, and like I said, we were busy from day one. And the reason we issued the report, I think, was twofold. First, it was a statutory requirement, and this is something that it was really new for our office. I don't think I'm aware of any other report requirement like that, not at least not in the laws that we've looked to in the past. But it was a statutory mandate. But the mandate was actually very straightforward, and it really required us to state the number of violation notices that we issued. There's a cure period in the law. It requires us to reach out to companies when we become aware of potential violations and we think those violations can be remedied. We have to issue a notice to companies and give a time frame for companies to respond and hopefully come into compliance. It's a 60-day time frame. So the requirement in the law was to state the number of those notices. And then building off of that, the number of violations that were cured and any other relevant information. So we could have answered this mandate very quickly. It could have been a paragraph. But the second reason we issued this report was because we felt like it was very important to do that for a few different reasons. One, during our legislative process, there were a lot of concerns expressed by stakeholders that we wouldn't be upfront about our enforcement efforts or our compliance expectations. And we tried again and again to dispel that notion. I think my office has always been very upfront about what we're seeing, what we expect. I think that benefits everyone. We are never trying to keep companies in the dark on these expectations. We regularly issue reports of our settlements for this very reason. So same as Sephora and DoorDash we were just talking about. That's the type of thing we've already done. But because we heard so much concern about that during the legislative proceedings, we felt like it was especially important to be detailed and to be transparent. The second reason is it really focused on these cure notices, but quantity isn't always quality. So we didn't want this statutory mandate to act as an incentive for us to just send a lot of letters for no reason. We want to be able to focus on the things that matter. And so it really would have been a disservice to just list a number without any context because that wouldn't have been, again, helpful for anyone. The number of notices issued isn't the important metric. It's about the number of notices issued and why. And then third, this notion of a cure is not really a simple construct. So like I said, the mandate asked us to identify the number of cure notices issued and how many issues were in fact cured. And that's not an easy thing to do. These are really complicated matters, and we have seen a lot of cooperation in response to our cure letters, but this raises a lot of interesting questions about what does a cure mean? Maybe you can fix some conduct going forward, but does that cure the problem? And this is something we are continuing to discuss every day on our end. And ultimately, we listed the number of notices sent, but all of these matters are unique, they're complex, and they are all ongoing. That's not because companies didn't cooperate, it's because these are a lot of very technical and complicated issues. And then, last but not least, that's only one facet of our work. So these cure notices for us was a new concept. This was the first time we've seen it in these privacy laws, or the first time we're dealing with like a mandatory cure notice for issues that can be cured. And but we do a lot of other work. We send inquiry letters, we send CIDs, we work in coordination with other states. So it really would have been, again, a disservice to focus only on the number of cure notices issued when we do so much other work and we have other laws that we look to, other tools to use to address these types of issues. So that was the reason for our enforcement report. I should have said upfront that we not only submitted it to the Connecticut legislature, but we did issue a press release with the report. And so you can find it. And please take some time to look through it. And we are all ears. Any comments, questions you have about the enforcement report, send them our way. We really did want this to be a useful report. And we've gotten some very good feedback. And I don't think this is the last time we will do something like this. So I don't know if it would be in a follow-on report or announcements related to particular issues or just using this type of feedback to inform some of our comments at speaking events like this. This really is our goal. We do want to be transparent, and please feel free to reach out to us if you have any questions or comments on the report.
Yeah, and I will put it on a plug. It's online. It's a relatively quick and good read. I'll try to put the link in the chat when I have a second for you to look at. Michelle, so again, the report was really interesting. Just if I can, so sort of you're making a distinction between the cure notices that you're sending versus I think you're doing a lot of more inquiries, privacy inquiries. Obviously, to the extent you can. What is leading you to send a cure notice versus pursuing other avenues?
Yes, so it's a great question. And so what Connecticut's law states is that it basically requires our office to afford an opportunity to, for businesses to come into compliance where there are potential violations of the law that we view to be remediable. And so what we have to do when we see when we receive complaints, we become aware of media reports about a privacy violation. It's just take stock of the issue involved and have to, we'd have to ask ourselves that question. Is this something, is this an issue that we do see a fix for? And I think one distinction that we've made is in some cases there could be like a facial issue that you see on the face of the matter itself versus there's other areas where you need a lot more information to even wrap your mind around the issue itself, and that doesn't lend very well to a cure letter. And that's a lot of our work. A lot of our investigations are really to explore those areas more and get our bearings before we can figure out what's going on. So a big focus of our cure letters had to do with privacy policies. And this is something that we said before our law took effect. We said we would be doing this. There are very important transparency requirements that Nick already mentioned in Connecticut's law that require clear statements about Connecticut residents' data privacy rights, which are very important. They require those rights mechanisms to be readily available and working. And so this was an area that we felt very fit very nicely into the cure notice structure. And so we hit the ground running. We started reviewing privacy policies day one, looking to see, is there any mention of Connecticut's Data Privacy Act? Are there any mention, is there any mention of Connecticut residents? On the one hand, as you both noted, there's over a dozen states with privacy laws already. We could be up to 20. I don't think by the end of this presentation, but maybe very soon. And we know that there's a balance between figuring out how to draft this language and privacy policies that cover these different laws. But they this these representations and the language need to be specific enough to really meaningfully inform the residents of those states of their data rights. And we saw a lot of confusing language. We saw a lot of privacy policies still only referencing California. We found a lot of broken links for data rights requests forms, inactive links. The issues ran the gamut. And I think we did have a lot of success sending these cure notices saying, hey, we reviewed your privacy policies. We're concerned this doesn't comply with Connecticut's law. And asking companies to take steps to come into compliance and let us know what they've done. So that was one of those areas that I think fit very nicely in a cure structure where there's other areas of the law that I'm not sure we'd ever be able to go down that route just because of the nature of the privacy violation itself.
Yeah, I think it's interesting and exciting to know that other people are looking at all the privacy notices and testing the links. I
Yes.
mean, it sounds like you really are. I mean, this isn't just people complaining about a particular privacy notice, that you are kind of actively going out and seeing what people have put up.
Yes. Yep. So, what I mean for a lot of these, we are all consumers,
Yeah.
and we are for Connecticut's law. I'm a Connecticut resident, and I have these rights too. So, I think these issues come to us because these are people's everyday experiences. We did a lot of work to try to get the word out about this law, how important it is. To encourage Connecticut residents to know the ins and outs of their new rights and to take steps to try to effectuate those. And I think that is critical for these laws, is just really making sure folks have the resources to take those steps because I think this is an overwhelming area. I think The common feeling we have about this is we hear from people who are really overwhelmed with the different steps you need to take to actually make these rights meaningful too. Where do I start? There's so many companies that have my data. There's different processes for all of these different companies, and we understand that, and we've been working very hard to try to figure out how can we help make this more manageable for people. But we're all doing this every day, and yeah, we arrive at these at this we arrive at this review in a bunch of different ways, but it's an everyday issue, so I think it's something that comes to us more naturally than some other areas would.
So speaking of other areas, though, you mentioned three other areas in the report. I'm wondering if you could speak to those too, in terms of, again, the notices and what you've been doing to date.
Yes, sure. So, when we were doing these events before our law took effect, we'd always get asked, what do you think some of your priorities would be? And one thing that we did is we said, we don't think those areas will be surprising just based on the strengths of Connecticut's law. So if you want a heads up about that, take a look at the areas where our office weighed in to make sure the law was strong, or Connecticut had heightened protections in certain areas. So three areas that fall under those lines that we highlighted in our enforcement report are sensitive data, teens data, I should say kids and teens data, and then data brokers. So to take a quick step back, the CTDPA provides enhanced protections for Connecticut residents' sensitive data, which is defined to hold to include a list of different categories. It includes genetic data, biometric data, precise geolocation, amongst other elements. And our law requires that companies obtain consumers' consent before processing that data. I think it's a really key area in our law, and that's one of those areas that aren't as apparent on the face of things. You have to ask, what information are you collecting? Sometimes privacy policies aren't very clear. Sometimes these consent mechanisms aren't obvious, and we've learned a lot as we've started looking into these issues, but we have focused on issues like the collection of palm data, the use of facial recognition software for purposes of deterring shoplifting, and the collection of sensitive data by connected vehicles, including location data. So these are all ongoing issues. So I can't provide a lot of detail about those, but I think very important areas where it's one of those areas where it's complex, and we are really trying to dig into that to make sure we have a full understanding and handle these matters as thoughtfully and carefully as we can. For teens data, this is one of those areas we highlighted up front because our office is very heavily involved on cases impacting children and teens. This has always been a priority for our office. It's especially a priority for my Attorney General, AG Tong, who has been very vocal about the need to protect kids online. And so this was another thing where our existing priorities helped us build this bridge into CTDPA enforcement focused on this vulnerable population. And the law provides that companies need to get consent before they process. Before they sell kids' data or they conduct targeted advertising. So we're doing a lot of work in that area right now and highlighted that in the enforcement report too. And then last but not least, data brokers. So this was one of those areas where there were some lessons learned from the initial state privacy laws that passed and some of the limitations to the language up front. So we focus very strongly on making sure that the CTDPA's deletion rights extended not just to personal data provided directly to a company, but to any data that's obtained about a person. And so this, I think, is an area that's just particularly murky to consumers. I think we all have a sense of how much information is collected about us and shared, but I think we really don't know the extent to which that information is collated and how it is used and how that impacts us in our everyday lives. So this is an area that we're focusing on a lot too.
Yeah, I mean that's interesting. I think in one of you made some policy recommendations at the end of the report that I don't think we're going to get into too significantly. But one of the policy recommendations you had made was adding a right similar to what you have in Oregon to actually know the specific third parties to whom data is disclosed. It sounds like, that's for those same reasons.
Yes. And that was something that came up in our legislative proceedings too. And we had mentioned it too, because the idea is, so if you submit a deletion request to one company, but you don't know all of the ways your information was shared before you submitted that deletion request, is that really meaningful? Or if you're submitting an opt-out request, but you have no way of tracking that downstream, how do you know whether that privacy choice is actually honored? And this idea of including a list of the specific third parties in privacy policy so that consumers can have some sense of what does that full list look like had come up in Connecticut. And at the time, what we heard was that's not possible. And we asked why. And I mean, my takeaway was it's because these lists are extensive. And so obviously, I think Oregon's update to the law is extremely important. And we have been tracking laws that have been passed in other states, bills that have been proposed, and our goal will be to make sure Connecticut residents have the same level of protection as residents of other states. It's one of those things where well, we were fifth, yeah, so not first, but we were towards the front of this. And I think these updates that states are making are really great. You have Maryland pa passing a law with very strong data minimization requirements, which is another area we paid a lot of attention to during our legislative process. So this is what the states are doing. And I do think there will be proposals for legislative updates in Connecticut and other states, just looking to those other states as new benchmarks.
Yeah, I want to talk about data minimization in a second, but just before we get there, consumer complaints. It sounded like you had, when you issued the report, received about 30. How much are those complaints really driving what you're looking at versus your own priorities?
Yeah, so just like the issues that I mentioned up front as running the gamut, I think the consumer complaints that we received also run the gamut. But we did a lot of legwork up front to make sure we'd be able to accept these complaints, identify them quickly, and be able to handle them properly. And we have been getting a good number of complaints. And to us, that is great. That means Connecticut residents are really trying to effectuate these rights. And some of them are very simple and straightforward. I tried to delete my data. I never heard back from the company. We'll send it over to the company and help prompt a response for that person. And we've seen that. So that is something that we think is really working. And there's, these are well-meaning companies, there's an issue. For some reason, the deletion request didn't get processed, and we can help that consumer out. But there's a lot of others that signal much, much greater issues too. So we made that point in our enforcement report that even a single consumer complaint can lead us down to a path to enforcement. And that is absolutely true. There have been a few of these that raise red flags from the get-go and have prompted either cure notices or inquiry letters, and sometimes inquiry letters to multiple different entities. And our office has a long history of accepting consumer complaints directly from Connecticut residents. And even though we don't represent private individuals, we represent the state, we undertake these mediation. I shouldn't say mediation. We almost act like as a middleman to try to prompt responses, and sometimes that is what it takes. Ideally, these, the Connecticut residents would get help up front, get responses quickly, but sometimes all it takes is an email from our office, and to resolve those. And I think we have had good results with that too.
Okay. And then my last question about the report is about this cure right. So the cure right is going to go away on December 31st, I think.
Yes.
But in the meantime, have businesses been curing? What's been happening?
Good point. Our cure period sunsets January 1st, I want to say. Hope I have that right. But I don't, I and we've seen a lot, of cooperation, a lot of progress. So I think overall, the businesses that we have reached out to have been very cooperative, responsive. We, like I said, we've seen a lot of progress. Some of these issues are thorny and we're still working on them, but that idea is like, have we seen cures? I don't know. I don't know what to call it because this construct is so strange. We've seen a lot of cooperation and good steps towards compliance. And I'm avoiding the word cure on purpose because these issues are thorny. What will we do after this cure period phases out? I don't think it's going to change our practices much at all. And to explain what I mean by that, I'll take a quick step back to talk about how we weighed in when this cure notice construct just came up in the legislative proceedings too. What we said time and again is we really didn't need that because our office can't jump to enforcement for every single matter. We can't litigate every case. This is very built into our practices where we'll identify a potential violation, but give a chance for companies to respond to us, tell its side of the story. We review responses and documents we get back carefully, and we are adept at basically organizing these different matters, putting them in context to each other, and focusing on the ones that really do warrant enforcement. So I don't think it will change much. I think this the cure period will sunset, but the permissive cure will continue, and there's factors in the law that kind of guides our office in determining whether or not we will continue sending cure letters. And you know, it's just me here, but I think we'll continue it. I think it's a good tool for us to use for these issues that are more facial for well-meaning companies. And then we have our other tools for issues that we need to react to right away and that are larger scale or egregious.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like there's some open and shut things like, hey, your link didn't work. You can probably cure that pretty easily. But
Right.
a lot of the issues you're delving into are bigger questions that take a
Right.
lot of
Right.
analysis.
We're
Yeah.
not interested in for these technical violations where it was clear it was just a mistake and there were step there were the company took steps to comply, and for some reason this was missed, and there was this broken li link. We're not interested in making those issues larger than they are.
Great. Well, so thank you very much for that. We've done a deep dive on the Connecticut report. Nick, I want to turn now to the other states. If you can, give us a sense of what are they doing? Has it been similar to what's happening in Connecticut?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe just quickly before we move to that, Michelle, I think it would be helpful because a lot of people find the report out of Connecticut to be really insightful and helpful. Maybe could you say a few words on the framework in which your office has to operate as to why individuals may see differences in terms of regulations in one state, a report like this in another state, or nothing in other states across the board? I think that might just be helpful to frame the report itself.
Yeah, I think so some of this depends on the substance of the law itself. So for us, we don't our office doesn't have rulemaking authority. So we're not charged with issuing regulations. So we didn't have that interface up front where whereas California and Colorado had their regulation issued their regulations and had those rulemaking processes where I think they were interacting with businesses more directly. They were accepting comments, incorporating comments. So I think that provided an outlet for those states to figure out which areas there were a call for more transparency and honor those requests through their regulations. And so for us, because we weren't issuing regulations, I think this enforcement report became wrapped into the law. And like I said, I don't think we really needed it. I think we would have aimed to do this anyway. But that was one thing that sent us down this road. So I think some of this, what you see from other states, will play out differently just based on the substance of their laws. But I do think overall there is this that a lot of states value being transparent and trying to put information out there. You already see it with some of these states who have laws coming online soon. I know Oregon just issued its FAQ pages, one for businesses, one for consumers. States are putting together some really good resources for both businesses and consumers. For businesses, like, here are the steps that you should be taking if you're trying to come online and comply, and for consumers to make things more manageable, including global opt-out rights and the steps you have to take to implement those, which are very complex, in fact. So I think it depends. It's not really a very clear answer to your question, but I think some of it is driven by the laws themselves, but I do think there's the states share this strong, it's a priority for us to get information out. I think it's better for everyone. We want to see compliance, and there are these overlapping goals of making sure these steps are taken up front and we're not having to deal with the harm later.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So yeah, I guess now we can turn to what we're seeing on the ground in terms of regulatory activity. And it does vary a fair amount from state to state. But what we are seeing is a lot of emphasis on sort of that initial consumer interaction with a company. There's a huge emphasis and attention on what your privacy notices say, what commitments are being made in those privacy notices, and a particular emphasis on how companies are describing their use of cookies and similar technologies online to collect information and how that information is being shared downstream with third parties. Particularly, you know, coming out of California, I think there's been a strong emphasis around some of the confusion or labeling around whether targeted advertising and online behavioral advertising ultimately constitutes a sale of personal data under the CCPA. We're seeing that under other states as well. And so what we are often seeing is some type of initial inquiry or letter coming to a company. Oftentimes, it's either triggered by a particular complaint that a consumer has raised to an office, or some type of media report, or generally just an industry sweep, which we see quite often, depending on the particular states. And what that letter will typically say is, you know, we have observed some potential deficiency within the law, and asking for an opportunity for the company to provide some feedback in terms of, you know, their current practices, to be able to address the concern, generally speaking, and provide a little bit more information around what ultimately they see as their current practices, and oftentimes trying to establish whether or not what their privacy notice says or what their disclosures say align overall. That tends to be a fair share of the activity we're seeing. Oftentimes, I think the regulators are really interested in that because it is what consumers are seeing upfront, right? Whether you have the right links to the disclosures right away, whether you're providing those rights in a way that is easy for folks to follow, whether your forms are actually sort of flowing in the process that someone would anticipate and not potentially putting a barrier in place to someone making a request. Kevin, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, but a lot of times what we end up seeing is issues where there was an attempt to make something correct the first time it was published, maybe when California came out, but ultimately a lack of attention to the privacy notice or business processes or you know, a broken technical link causes issues downstream that can really cause a lot of trouble amongst both the consumers and regulators.
Yeah, I mean, I think regulators are still learning right now. And it's easy to go after some of the low-hanging fruit, and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I thought it was interesting, for example, Michelle already mentioned data minimization. So only, you know, collecting and storing the data that you need for a particular purpose and not, you know, having more data than you need. California recently came out with an enforcement advisory, and they were talking about data minimization, the principle generally, but what they were immediately focused on was data minimization in the context of verifying people's identity in response to consumer rights requests. Because I think, you know, that was just something, one, they probably got complaints about it, and two, it's just something more tangible that you can wrap your hands around. Like, we can actually see in response to these data subject rights requests when companies are asking for more information than they probably actually need to verify consumer rights requests. Otherwise, I mean, I think it seems like other regulators are focused on issues that are pretty similar to what Michelle has already talked about, in terms of sensitive data, children's data, vulnerable populations, and we'll talk more about that in a second in terms of regulatory priorities going forward. Just two other points I wanted to make about enforcement to date. Not surprisingly, California has been out in front on a lot of this. That's for several reasons. Just two to note. One, they were first. Their law has been in operation for the longest, and so they've had a chance to get up and running. Two, it's not just the California Privacy Protection Agency, which has been in place for what, a year now, thereabouts, longer than that. So, but it's the Connecticut Attorney General's office has also been enforcing the law, and of course, the Connecticut Attorney General's office has a lot of experience with this. And so, because there is concurrent jurisdiction there, you've had both agencies able to prioritize different facets of the law and move forward. So we already mentioned DoorDash and Sephora, where the Connecticut Attorney General's office has been quite focused on targeted advertising and honoring opt-out requests in response to do not sell requests, and in particular, global privacy control and other online mechanisms for sending automatic opt-out requests.
And just another thing to point out that we're seeing a lot in terms of investigations is oftentimes we will see investigations relating to data collection and sort of sharing practices with technologies that are automatically sort of merged in with your offerings. So think cookies on websites, SDKs within mobile applications. And a lot of times, or sometimes, we'll see companies that say, I never really even understood exactly what was flowing downstream to these sort of third parties. And so it's important to keep in mind it may be your practices that are ultimately the focus of a regulatory inquiry or investigation, but it can also be the practices of your partners and ultimately what you're introducing into your own ecosystem that can cause potential downstream issues, particularly if you're not fully understanding the data flows and what ultimately those partners may be doing with that data.
Yeah, Nick, and if you look at, you mentioned the enforcement sweeps that California has been involved in, so they've highlighted particular industries or topic areas that they're looking at. So streaming applications, retail travel and food industries focused in particular on their mobile applications, connected cars, a lot of this is getting at that issue about how is the data flowing downstream. The third one, which I think is interesting as well, was California AG was focused on employees and job applicants data. And that actually raises, I think, another interesting point, which is, and Michelle, maybe you can speak to this as well. A lot of states are focused on unique aspects of their laws. So California really, in terms of comprehensive privacy laws, is the only one that applies directly to employees and job applicants. And I think that was one of the reasons probably why they were focused on that issue. Michelle, have you also seen that?
And that was so it didn't initially, right? I hope I'm saying this right, but there was that moratorium which then phased out, and then employee data was wrapped in. So that was one that is a good way to highlight that some of these nuances in different state laws could be those areas where states take a look. So the timing made sense. It was definitely based on that nuance in California law. And yes, that is what I think other states will be doing too, is there's always going to be broader areas. You made a good point that privacy enforcement has been going on for a very long time. These laws are new, but when my AG does events like this, he likes to make the point of that what is old is new again, because we've been doing privacy enforcement for a long time, with a lot of states prioritizing these issues, for many years, and we've had some really good settlements that have come out of those investigations. But these laws solidify requirements that we have made the point often already existed, but they've added a lot of teeth behind these protections, and companies, I think, need to pay attention to the different nuances in different states and just be on notice that those are could be the areas where regulators pay attention to.
So let's talk about enforcement priorities going forward. Michelle, as you know, I attended a panel in which you were speaking. So can you maybe give us a preview of some of your office's enforcement priorities going forward?
Yes, for sure. So yep, this is just building off of what I just said. I think there's a lot of different things that set an office's enforcement priorities. As I mentioned up, well, as we've already discussed, consumer complaints can prompt some of these areas of inquiry, media reports. We are paying attention to what comes out from consumer advocacy groups. We coordinate with other states. We speak very regularly to our privacy colleagues in other states. We talk to federal regulators, and these are all the types of things that end up going into the discussion about priorities. But for Connecticut, a really interesting feature of our law is that it was amended before it even took effect. We had SB 3 in Connecticut, which, well, last year's SB 3, that updated our law in two really important areas. First, it added protections for consumer health data, including requirements that companies not sell or share consumer health data without letting Connecticut residents know and obtaining specific consent for that. And then there were also a lot of really important protections added for kids and teens. So, and this by this I mean anyone under 18 years of old, 18 years of age. So this is a wider group. The protections are really important. So I think this is one of the points I've made. As states update their laws and they expand protections in these areas, that will drive that office's enforcement work. So I think these are areas that our office will absolutely pay attention to. I did want to mention two other things that I don't think I threw in the mix for the last event. But another thing that we are paying a lot of attention to are data protection assessments. So that was an important area of the law too. It's almost like bringing this risk assessment concept and privacy by design concepts into this privacy law. And it requires companies to do legwork up front to really assess these projects that implicate consumer privacy and think about the risks, think about how those risks can be managed or offset, and to document those assessments. So this is something that's really interesting to us. I think it's really important. And it's something that if companies are complying with Connecticut law, that they would have already needed to be doing if you're handling sensitive data or your processing activities trigger any of the other requirements that make these data protection assessments something that your business needs to do. So this was something that I think we needed a little time for because we understood that this some of this is building off of the effective date, but because of the timing now, we're almost a year out. Something I wanted to throw out there as something that our team is paying attention to, and I think will be going forward. And then another thing with the timing, just like California's moratorium for the employee data phasing out, our global opt-out provision is phasing in. So that's also January 2025, and we are starting to discuss that a lot internally too. We're starting to think about resources that we could issue on that requirement. Hopefully, you'll see something from our office on that before the actual requirement takes effect. But it is a critical component of our law. I already talked about how Connecticut residents feel overwhelmed, and this was a protection that was meant to get at that. So, how do you make it easier for people to effectuate these rights across the board rather than having to go to hundreds of different websites to really have a meaningful effect. And so I figured I'd put that in there too, because again, it's the nuances of the law and the time frames, and a lot of that drives offices' work.
So just in terms of other states to fill in the gaps, just some enforcement priorities that we've heard offices discussing. They're pretty similar to what we've been talking about already, but they include sensitive data, in particular, again, health data. And then, Michelle, you mentioned biometric data. That seems to be a priority for a number of offices. There's a lot of focus on vulnerable populations, and that includes teens and children. But I think it was California has mentioned, just don't limit it just to teens and children. Obviously, there's particular provisions that apply to teens and children, but if you've got, for example, elderly populations or populations which may with maybe not the same English language skills, those are some other types of people that regulators are wanting to ensure are adequately protected. There's certainly been a focus on consent and opt-out procedures, particularly around targeted advertising, sale of data, dark patterns. This is one of those. So a dark pattern for those who don't speak privacy lingo, it's if basically you have some sort of rights mechanism or something similar that's guiding you toward a less privacy protective choice. So for example, if your consent mechanisms says, do you want to consent to this? And you say no, and then they say, really, you don't want to? There's all these reasons why you should consent to this. That could potentially be a dark pattern, hopefully depending on how it's worded, but that's that sort of thing. And that's a feature that a number of regulators have talked about enforcing in the future. I thought it was interesting that an individual from the California Privacy Protection Agency said basically this has been in our regulations for quite some time now. Don't bury your head in the sand. We're going to be looking at this issue. So that's something. And then one other issue, Michelle, that you have already mentioned that I think is starting to get a lot more publicity, in part because laws like Maryland have come out with very strong data minimization provisions. While Maryland's is stronger, there are data minimization provisions in all of these laws. And so this is just my reading the tea leaves. I think that's likely to be an area of focus for regulators going forward as well.
And I honestly, when we talk about with companies about what steps they can take to comply, data minimization is the first thing we focus on every single time because all of these laws have thresholds for application. There are heightened protections for more sensitive data. So the best way you could lower your risk is by not collecting information you don't need. And sometimes, we've heard, okay, but it's so challenging. We have all the sensitive data, and there could be technical challenges involved with implementing some of these protections. But our answer is, if you're collecting sensitive data, you've got to comply. So really, it's I think very important for companies to take stock of what they need and what they don't. And I've mentioned this before, but we have a long history of work on the data breach side of things, and this is an issue across the board in our data breach cases too. I can't tell you how many we've worked on where it's a very large a large list of data that's impacted. It's millions of people, and we ask, why did you have this data? And there isn't a good reason for that. So I think even on the data security side of things, this has been a priority for us, a theme of ours for quite some time. And now it's always been for privacy too, but it's becoming more and more apparent to us as we look at these cases, how critical it is for companies to take this step up upfront and really be careful about it.
So I just have a few more questions, and then maybe we can do some wrap-ups of anything we've missed along the way. But I did, since you're here, Michelle, want to take the opportunity to ask you if you have any advice for people dealing with your office.
Yes. Well, first of all, just being upfront, being cooperative, being proactive. Like I said, this has always been part of our practice is when we become aware of an issue, we reach out to companies, we ask questions, trying to get at the heart of the issue. And I think the biggest mistake we see is just companies not being forthright, providing vague answers to our questions. And for us, we're trying to do our jobs and we're not gonna be able to understand a matter quickly if it feels like we're having to pull teeth to get that information. It's just gonna extend an investigation. And if I think there's some cases, including one I'm thinking about right now, is had the company taken a different approach, provided the information upfront, we would have closed it months before we did. We can't pursue every single matter. Like I said, we are prioritizing the ones that are important. There are a lot of matters that we do end up closing because we hear from a company and our concerns are addressed and alleviated. So I think really just being cooperative, being forthcoming, letting us understand the issue, telling your story, addressing any issues quickly, and including that as part of the story, these are all things that we'd want to see.
Great. And Nick, from your experience dealing with regulators and enforcement authorities, do you have any tips?
Yeah, I will say, these laws are not written perfectly, and there is a fair amount of wiggle room in terms of interpretation. Because of that, when we're handling investigations in relation to regulators, we often will advise clients not to take a hard stance that just says, like, no, we absolutely believe everything we did is perfect. What you want to do is be able to put forth a story that says, we took a reasonable interpretation of the law. This is where we came out. And we do often find we get the best results when we can go to the regulators and say, but we understand the concern you're raising. Here are maybe some improvements that we could make proactively. And oftentimes, if we do that, it doesn't end up in enforcement. We end up getting improvements to the disclosures of the mechanisms in a way that works better for the company than if it's being imposed on them. And it shows sort of the thought that went into and behind what ultimately is put forth. So I agree with Michelle in terms of cooperation can be effective. It's not a admitting to wrongdoing or automatically throwing yourself under the bus. It's really being strategic about taking steps to show the process you went through and potentially acknowledging that there are always ways to improve privacy pretty much across the board.
I would just agree with that wholeheartedly. Like, we understand that perfection is not the standard. And I really do think it would help if you kind of like just think about what would you have to show for these efforts if you were to receive an inquiry. So do some of that stuff up front. What are the steps that we've taken to comply and make sure they are documented? They're easy to provide because that the steps that businesses take up front to ensure compliance matter. And then, as Nick said, if you do become aware of an issue, taking these remedial steps quickly, addressing the issues, basically like making sure the story has a good end to it too. All of these things are really important.
Great. Well, I just want to open the floor for any final takeaways. Nick, is there anything we missed?
Nothing in particular that we missed. I just want to reiterate sort of what we talked about. Doing upfront work is important. It's easy to say, we don't have the budget to do this right away. But to the extent you can put time and energy upfront, building out compliance programs, doing the monitoring, you can oftentimes get ahead of these and avoid a lot of the issues that ultimately would rise to the level of Michelle's office.
Completely agree. I think that proactive approach is extremely helpful. It's what we want to see, it's what we expect. So just couldn't agree more with Nick's comments.
Yeah. And I think we mentioned this before. I mean, at the very least, make sure you handle the low-hanging fruit because, I mean, Michelle's office is looking at your privacy notice. So get that up to speed as a start. And then absolutely, I mean, compliance with these privacy laws is tough. There's principles underlying them, and actually implementing those principles throughout the organization is it's a process. It's something that you have to work on constantly to do successfully. But making sure you've started that process and can have things that you can show to Michelle's office or other regulators if they do ask so that they can see that progress that you are making. So I want to thank Michelle again and Nick for your participation, and thanks to the attendees. If you have any questions, I know I'm happy to answer any follow-ups. So feel free to reach out. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.